listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Dance All Night by Lily Annalick. On February 10th, 1984, the law caught up with Eddie Dodson, or maybe it was reality. There was a standoff at the Farmer's Daughter Motel on Fairfax. The cops' guns weren't starter pistols, and they dragged Dodson off to jail, and that was that. The rhapsody of sex, rebellion, fatalism in the movies was over. Fake Club went down at around the same time, December 83. Physical and emotional limits had been reached. Says Fortune, I was doing more music videos. One morning, I got in the car, and I couldn't get the key in the ignition. I thought, this has to stop. It was bigger, though, than a change in Fortune personally. In the 2 short years of Fake Club's existence, there had also been a change in the culture at large. People were strung out. The drug scene was dying, or at least going underground, and freaked out. We'd been more aware of this mystery disease. Friends were disappearing, but we hadn't quite figured it out, so we partied. Then it got serious. The irony was, after Fake Club, L.A.'s club scene exploded. Making the loudest kaboom was Power Tools, founded in 1985 by Fortune's former roomie Brad Branson and Matt Dyke, with John Seidel joining later. So why did Power Tools rise to legend and Fake Club fall into obscurity? Did Fake Club come along too soon, before people realized a trend had begun and to perk up, pay attention? Or was it that Fake Club, which catered to a slightly older crowd, the 30-plus boomers, was getting supplanted by a new generation? Branson, Seidel, and Dyke were all Xers. Or was Fake Club so close to a dream that it dissolved in the mind the way a dream dissolves, leaving behind no residue or ripple? Though Fortune continued to go to clubs, he never again ran one. He'd moved on. An easy transition for him, as it turned out. The directors of those music videos were suddenly rich. They bought houses. They knew Fortune could dress a set, so why not a house? Out of the blue, he had a whole new line of work, interior design, for which he'd become celebrated. His clients including Marc Jacobs and David Fincher. He'd also co-create Le Deux Café, remake the Sunset Tower Hotel, act in Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette. Foreman moved on as well. I quickly realized that you couldn't duplicate Fake Club. It was a mixture of magic and chemicals and people and timing. Money, too, or lack thereof. Once word got out that these clubs were bringing in heavy cash, the artists and renegades were done for. Everything became formalized, corporatized. Fortune, we opened Fake Club for a couple $100. It would take $20 million to open that same club today, and it wouldn't be any better. In fact, it would be worse. A certain innocence, a certain esprit was lost. We had control. We didn't have to listen to hedge fund guys or whomever. We could do it ourselves. That it wasn't serious, that it wasn't professional, is why it worked. Why it was special. If you can't fake it, don't make it. nerve agent. WME's Ari Emanuel planned to put his agency and the very power structure of Hollywood on the line with an audacious, now-scuttled public offering. With that future on hold, and the likes of Netflix and Disney commanding more ground by the day, Richard Rushfield takes the mood among the mockers. Opening illustration by Christina Zimpel. Grand ambition, Ari Emanuel hatched a plan to use a talent agency to compete with Hollywood's tech upstarts. And the illustration looks like an Andy Warhol stylized caricature. The gloom filling the Goldman Sachs conference room that Thursday was undeniable. This was supposed to be a celebration. After 2 decades watching the tech world run laps around Hollywood and ultimately threaten to devour it, Endeavor Incorporated and Ari Emanuel, the perpetual ambition machine who has served as its engine for decades, were about to break into the League of Titans with that ultimate corporate bar mitzvah, an IPO, the first agency in Hollywood history to go public. The 7,000-employee media conglomerate, forged long ago on the back of a boutique talent agency specializing in TV writers, was to become a giant outside its own walled-off industry, backed by the public capital of investors large and small. After 24 years of relentless growth, this was the big event. They would acquire the capital not just to make those who had followed Emanuel and his hyperkinetic vision all these years very rich, but that would allow the company to truly compete with the very forces that have reshaped the entertainment industry in the last decade: Netflix, Amazon, and Disney. In October, WME began representing Condé Nast Entertainment, a division of Vanity Fair's parent company, Condé Nast. 4 months before, the IPO process had kicked off with customary Emanuel-esque fanfare and bravado, hailing the future of entertainment media. But there were signs for concern. The years leading to the finish line had seen the company's first extended rough patch. Things arguably started in 2016 with the matter of Donald Trump, whom William Morris Endeavor repped in his previous life as a game show host. It certainly didn't hurt Lou Wasserman when his former client Ronald Reagan entered the White House, but this was a different kind of calling card entirely. Then, like every company in Hollywood, Endeavor had been forced to take stock of its culpability in the industry's power structure, thanks to the hashtag MeToo era that Trump's election had helped presage. They have had to publicly announce investigations into harassment accusations against 2 agents. Add to that the matter of WME's newest investor, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, whom Emanuel hosted on his grand tour of Hollywood in the spring of 2018, as had Rupert Murdoch and Bob Iger. The goodwill resulted in a $400 million investment, a check Emanuel felt compelled to return after the Saudi-backed murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi 6 months later. In March came the Writers Guild dispute, which saw TV writers fire their agents en masse over what they saw as agency overreach when it comes to packaging fees. The standoff has dragged on since. It had been a tough stretch on the personal front as well. Both Emanuel and WME partner Patrick Whitesell saw marriages end in recent years. The latter's breakup became international tabloid fodder when word got out that his wife was having an extramarital affair with the lord of Amazon himself, Jeff Bezos. Market forces weren't exactly in WME's favor either. In the weeks ahead of its planned IPO, high-flying tech launches built by charismatic founders had floundered or wrecked beneath sudden Wall Street skepticism. WeWork's smash-up, still unfolding as the Endeavor gang gathered in the Goldman offices, was so spectacular and tragicomic that it sucked the appetite for newfangled business models right out of the market. Then, on the eve of Endeavor's pricing, Peloton hit the skids. The cultish home workout brand downgraded its offering and prepared to open even below that new low. And yet, on this day, all such matters, macro and micro, were back of mind as WME and its bankers set to crunching the numbers to arrive at a stock valuation, and then crunch them again and again. Emmanuel and the team worked the figures with the Goldman advisors, searching for a scenario, any scenario, that would produce an inside straight. Nothing seemed to work, and slowly the room began to realize that going public would mean setting a price far below what they had come for, and probably getting even less than that. For the many agents and executives of William Morris Endeavor, who had followed Emmanuel through the wilderness, working at reduced pay in exchange for equity, it was the jackpot deferred. And for many observers, both in and outside the company, it was the unthinkable. The unstoppable Ari Emmanuel had met an immovable object. Word quickly got out, and from one end of town to the other, the schadenfreude flowed. After decades of watching Emmanuel grow, dangerously, recklessly, so many had warned, finally the comeuppance. WME President Ari Greenberg was en route to the New York Stock Exchange for the traditional bell ringing and had to be called back. Someone forgot to cancel the in-and-out truck that had been ordered for the next day's soiree at the company's headquarters. The would-be centerpiece of the celebration became a glum consolation. No zillions this year, but here's a cheeseburger. In the days to come, stories ricocheted across L.A. of real estate agents who suddenly found their weekends free as WME agents canceled their appointments to search for that perfect upgrade in the hills. By December, the New York Post was reporting that a number of agents at the company were feeling burned and eyeing the exits. "The first rule of agenting is don't count your chickens," said one observer. A lot of people had calculated the price tags on a lot of chickens. Such sentiment shouldn't come as a surprise in a town that's never been rich in sympathy for one's rivals. But speaking to other agents and industry players in the months since WME's failure to launch has yielded much more than just the usual told-you-sos and grave dancing. As of this writing, the entire entertainment industry is marching toward a cliff commonly called the streaming wars. After years of ignoring the disruptive potential of on-demand video and actively licensing their product to their usurpers, the button-downed mandarins of today's Hollywood have finally taken note. Everyone is spending at levels never seen before to try to capture a piece of the new market, which may, in the course of things, displace not just traditional cable money, but the entire movie business. Does any of this add up? What lies on the other side of the cliff? No one knows, but it will certainly bring ruin and disaster for at least some of them. Is each little Hollywood fiefdom meant to sit patiently and wait to be swallowed? Since the 80s, but really, even back to the days of radio, agencies have supplemented their 10% commissions with packaging fees, an arrangement through which an agency bundles clients into one project and forgoes its usual commission for a share of the eventual revenue. The upside became so lucrative in recent years that it essentially paid for A-list agenting, offices, suits, cars, travel. The arrival of the streaming giants caused the packaging well to dry up. The streamers, by and large, pay huge prices for shows and their rights, which means no back end or ownership. For the agencies, that meant falling back on a business of working just for commissions. Endeavor's push to grow and diversify can be seen as a need to have a product that's more durable and independent of the goodwill of clients, whose own career lifespans are getting shorter. Love it or hate it, WME's moonshot had come to represent, and may yet still, a different kind of Hollywood future, one grounded in a romanticized version of its past as home to outsized egos and galactic ambitions. Emmanuel's fate presented a veritable whiteboard upon which so many in town could mark up their own existential anxieties. So have we reached the natural limits of how far a brash, swashbuckling showbiz mogul can go on energy and imagination? Or is a force of nature like Aridum not to be that easily derailed? One can't overstate just how big a splash Ari Emanuel, who declined to speak for this article, has made in Hollywood for so long now. From his very earliest days out of the training program at Creative Artist Agency, and then as a young upstart agent with 1,000 words a minute elocution at the mid-tier firm Intertalent, legends of Emanuel's ambition have been a constant. By his mid-20s, Emmanuel had become a devotee of the futurist George Gilder, whose 1990 book Life After Television anticipated the streaming era. Still barely more than a trainee, Emmanuel brought the writer predicting a post-network world to speak at the agency, which was then living at the height of traditional network deals. It wasn't all techno-futurism and media theory. A hard-charging, frattish culture took shape around the young Intertalent group. Trash-talking at the weekly office basketball games was so fearsome that even hardened Hollywood players wilted before the put-downs. There was one game where my agent's assistant was fouling me hard, and calling me a useless moron, recalls one occasional player. And when in 1995, Emmanuel and three other agents broke off on their own to form the Endeavor Talent Agency, the legend only grew. There was the hazing, one early Endeavor employee recalls. It was this group of guys who were all interconnected. They had the boarding school connections, a lot of Harvard, and you felt that when you went there. It was frat-type guys running their company like a frat. The antics would later be embarrassingly revealed in 2002 when agent Sandra Epstein sued the firm, alleging a culture of sex on desk, casual pot smoking, and one instance of an assistant being ordered to book prostitutes for his boss. The suit was settled out of court. The stories of Emmanuel's volcanic temper became a subgenre of their own. Tales of him berating employees or rivals, lobbing projectiles across the office, or, as one observer remembers fairly recently, beating to death his laptop in his building's garage. There are his health regimens. At 6'1" and a lean 165 pounds, Emmanuel practices a strict vegan diet with intermittent fast. He works at a treadmill desk. In the mid-aughts, Entourage and Jeremy Piven introduced an exaggerated idea of Emmanuel to the broader public consciousness. But not even a premium cable parody builds a legend like success. In 1995, Endeavor came into being as a nearly micro-boutique with a specialty in TV writers at a time when the agency world was defined by the overwhelming shadow of Mike Ovitz and Ron Myers, CAA, unchallenged champion of the 10% world. Emmanuel and his hard-driving partners grew their little boutique to the point wherein the important, soon to be all-important world of TV series creation, they challenged and even surpassed CAA in deals. In 2009, the feisty startup did the impossible and merged with, effectively swallowed up, the stalwart of Hollywood stalwarts, the William Morris Agency, still a formidable company, particularly in the music business, where Endeavor was weak. In the absorption, Emmanuel and William Morris Endeavor became the first true rival CAA had seen, eventually joining in along with UTA, ICM, and Paradigm in the five-part hegemony that has presided since. The rivalry with CAA also created another comparison between Emmanuel and the great deal-maker of the previous generation, Ovitz. In his 2018 memoir, Ovitz himself called Emmanuel and Weitzel his real heirs. One can take this as a swipe at his own former protégés, or as an attempt to aggrandize himself by association with Emmanuel's building of the sort of multi-pronged media company he was never able to turn CAA into. But the comparisons to Ovitz, a slash-and-burn business practitioner, have their limits. Emmanuel, despite the yelling and laptop beating, engenders a remarkable loyalty from those around him. Former assistants gush, which is almost unheard of in Hollywood. Even outsiders who are extremely skeptical of his imperial designs can't help but lavish praise. Ari is the hardest working man in this business. There is no one more dedicated to his company, says one source I spoke with for this piece, having finished tearing down the greater Endeavor vision. As WME grew, Emmanuel hatched a plan to use a talent agency, of all things, to combat the tech interlopers awakening to Hollywood's potential. It's a plan that demonstrates Emmanuel's singular place in Hollywood circa 2020. For more than a century, the film business has been a sanctuary for moderately unhinged geniuses. To pursue their dreams on an epic scale, very few of the type still roam free, certainly not at the helm of heavily capitalized companies. In the Entourage version of Emmanuel's life, the character ends up taking over a studio and becoming effectively King of Hollywood. In the real-life script of Hollywood circa 2020, those studio chief slots, when they do come open, seem invariably to go to buttoned-down and previously unknown corporate types. The man who stands as the unquestioned leader of traditional Hollywood right now, Robert Iger, perhaps the most successful executive in showbiz history, is the anti-mad genius, a king of common sense. Hollywood has slowly ceded its claim as global grand visionary capital to Silicon Valley and watched while a succession of wunderkinds has created the modern world's miracles from the realms of tech, not entertainment. Then a couple of guys named Reed and Ted dropped in on the industry with a mail-order DVD business, and in a few years had half the town working for them. When this all began to unfold, the agencies were still rich in the era of home media revenues and giant packaging fees from broadcasters, an arrangement that allowed them to own a percentage of the show in place of commissions and share in the resulting revenues. The streaming era might as well have been a 7-mile-wide comet. Recalls one agent, the change of the last decade has been relentless and terrifying. In 2013, Netflix had one show on the air, and they were the only streaming service. Then HBO aired True Detective, and the agent says the walls came tumbling down between movies and TV. Sensing a tectonic shift, WME saw an opportunity to go where no agency had gone before. The notion was to build on the hub of an agency what Emmanuel has called a 21st century media company, a galaxy of entertainment and cultural businesses and servicing arms, media rights, legal support, etc., that help grow those businesses, through which clients could build out and own the products of their talents in a variety of fields. Seeing a future in which 2 to 5 companies control and wholly own all of traditional entertainment, The IRI plan was to turn Endeavor into a counterweight to the streamers and studios, giving clients outside avenues to control their destinies. On came a slew of acquisitions that on their faces seemed to have little to do with the business of a Hollywood talent agency, but might provide such opportunities down the line. The Ultimate Fighting Championship, Miss Universe competition, Freeze Art Fairs, Fashion Week, Professional Bull Riders. To Endeavor supporters, it was a recognition that the real competition for Disney, Netflix, or Apple won't be other streaming services, but the stars themselves, who, by creating industries around themselves and building international followings, become more valuable than just the next job they book. Think Dwayne Johnson or Rihanna. There were reasons no agency had gone there before. To start with, there are laws. The state of California, in particular, has traditionally but not lately enforced very strict rules against agencies, creating conflicts of interest by controlling the means of production, as they were. But the political representatives who oversee these matters had started to let things slide. With the amount of money Hollywood contributes to politicians in the state, Emmanuel seems to have sensed they weren't about to start getting tough again anytime soon. But there were also unwritten rules. The moves put WME in contact with the third rail in agenting. It started producing its own movies and TV shows via Endeavor Content, which had a hand in La La Land and Killing Eve, among many other projects. To detractors, this furious growth was megalomaniac, Emmanuel empire building for its own sake. Nothing is enough for them, says one observer. Ari's on a mission to make himself a captain of industry, as opposed to leaving well enough alone at a time when you can make a fortune as an agent. Skeptics claim the Endeavor empire has ceased to serve the agency's clients and become its own beast, demanding to be fed at the client's expense, forcing agents to funnel clients to in-house projects from the many corporate arms rather than pursuing better deals elsewhere. At the head of the agency meeting, it's the same group of guys who own 100% of the voting stock, needing to support all the branches of their company, says one observer. I don't know what they are selling, one veteran says. Endeavor says that if it ceases to operate in its clients' best interest, they can walk, any time. Wall Street has never shown much interest in Hollywood talent agencies, and maybe with good reason. An agency is always one bad lunch with a movie star away from a wrecking ball through the balance sheet. As one veteran put it, it's a business where your merchandise walks out the door every night. The audacity of Emmanuel, many see, has been to tie around the agency such a collection of other stuff that the agency itself and the fluctuations of individual stars becomes less critical. And indeed, in the current Endeavor, even without the IPO, the entire WME agency accounts for only about 30% of the company's cash flow. To the naysayers, it's scale, for the sake of dazzling investors in hope of luring Wall Street cash, and a dangerous distraction for the core business. To true believers, it's the hedge against the very scary future Hollywood is mindlessly barreling toward. Amid all the dislocation and insanity, some around town wish that someone out there were trying something different, something crazy even. And let's not get totally ahead of ourselves. There's still plenty of schadenfreude, too. The TV writers gladly took credit for having a hand in WME's launchpad sputter. Expert opinions vary as to how much is deserved. But the heavily corporatized entities currently running the place have displayed little appetite, even in the face of looming disaster, for the craziness and big visions that have built Hollywood. which brings us back to that IPO deferred. As Emmanuel has told confidants, these giant streaming Goliaths are fated to attack each other for the same market, while a new world, a whole new world of completely different entertainment experiences arises. Snapchat, live events, what have you. Which was the road Endeavor started down, one in which talent agency is no longer the core definition, and one in which Emmanuel positioned himself to become a hybrid mogul studio boss, unlike anyone else in town. With the IPO nixed, those plans may have to wait. From within the agency, sources paint a more determined future. While the disappointment is certainly palpable and still raw with anyone you speak to, people familiar with the company's finances are unequivocal. Cash flow, they say, is ample to sustain the business and service the debt. Its Moody's rating remains top drawer, and investment money is still available to fund further growth. In November, Endeavor made yet another acquisition, the Harry Walker Agency, a firm specializing in speakers engagements, and announced a program to buy back shares from its employees, compensating those who missed their chance for the big score. Further, they point to the fact that the company was able to pay back the Saudis and cut ties. Uber, another of this year's IPO class, seems unable to take the same leap, earning itself eternal blowback. So, is this the end of Emmanuel's world-devouring ambitions? Has reality bitten hard enough that he'll settle down, focus on tending to the agency, and play nice? As one industry veteran and Endeavor skeptic admits, I don't think a new IPO makes any sense at all, but maybe it's still doable. If you're a great salesman, you can sell anything. People have talked to Emmanuel recently report a man disappointed but unbowed, and looking at how this experience could make him and the company stronger. He recently told one colleague, "There's no such thing as failure. You learn from every experience. I'm not looking at how big my stack of cash is. I'm looking to grow something about where the world is going." People put it in economic terms, but success is about what you learn. And in Hollywood, there is always, always another act. If you're not beautiful, you're finished. The Hollywood blacklist, sex on sets, ageism, sexism, the charms of Warren Beatty. The elegant, indomitable, Oscar-winning actor and director Lee Grant speaks the truths of a lifetime by Julie Miller. Opening photo, pushing back. Lee Grant, seen here in a 1970 TV movie, turned to directing to have a voice. On top of being an Oscar-winning actor and a trailblazing documentarian, Lee Grant is a lovely host, quick-witted, warm, and fiercely candid about the obstacles that life and Hollywood continue to throw into the path of women. Grant, who is now in her early 90s, made a sensational film debut opposite Kirk Douglas in 1951's Detective Story, winning Best Actress at Cannes, as well as being nominated for an Academy Award. Then, the blacklist struck. While giving a eulogy, Grant had suggested that an actor friend's death had been hastened by the trauma of being questioned by the House Un-American Activities Committee. She was largely sidelined between the ages of 24 and 36. Compounding her difficulties was an unhappy relationship with her first husband, blacklisted screenwriter Arnold Manoff, which Grant chronicles in her memoir, I Said Yes to Everything. When Grant returned to the screen in the mid-1960s, the ageism of the industry was debilitating. Still, she won the 1966 Supporting Actress Emmy for Peyton Place, the 1976 Supporting Actress Oscar for Shampoo, and earned two additional Academy Award nominations for The Landlord and Voyage of the Damned. In the 1980s, Grant pivoted to filmmaking, presciently shining a light on social issues like income inequality and poverty in America, most notably in her Oscar-winning 1986 documentary Down and Out in America. During my three-hour visit to her home on Manhattan's Upper West Side, Grant gave me a tour of the artwork and personal photographs papering her walls, referred me to her Pilates instructor, and offered me sincere relationship advice. After settling into a comfortable corner of her bedroom, she talked passionately about a range of subjects. They included the horrors leveled at women in the industry, her memories from the sex-crazed set of Shampoo, and her happy second marriage to producer and painter Joseph Fury. In your memoir, you described a pivotal moment with your then-husband that encapsulates so many themes about not just being a woman, but being a woman in Hollywood. You were offered an acting job, and your husband told you he would leave you if you took it. You were in your mid-30s, you'd been blacklisted, and hadn't worked steadily in years, and you took the job. My first marriage was with somebody who had no need for me at all. He had two boys he didn't want to give to the boy's mother, because he'd have to pay alimony. So he wanted me to basically be an au pair who would be there, cook dinner, and take care of the boys, so he could make a living. That's exactly what I became, until he said, "If you leave, we're finished." Thank God his feelings toward me were so evident that at last my pride wouldn't let me go back there to take care of the children. I had no control over my life. I had a daughter who was about 4 at the time, and I knew that if I didn't work, I'd lose her. My whole focus at that time was to keep Dinah. If I didn't have her, I had nothing. I had no other means of making a living. The only thing I could do was act, and I had to look 29 for this part. You went to what, for the time, were great lengths to make sure you did look 29. You got a facelift. Did you hear of other actresses doing the same thing? No, but I was sick. It was neurosis. I was so panicked after being blacklisted from 24 to 36. I mean, think about that age. It's your prime age as an actress. It's the only age. At 36, you're a character actress. I didn't even enter Hollywood until 36, and I spent the next 12 years trying to hide my age every way I could. On my passport, on my driver's license, in publicity. I really was panicked they would find out how old I was and not hire me. You get a little nuts. This was in the 1950s. Were you scared that something might go wrong during the facelift procedure? No, it was, please, save my life. As women, we're taught that so much of our worth is appearance-related. When you're an actress, that pressure must be exponentially worse. That's all that exists in Hollywood for women. If you're not beautiful, you're finished. You can be cute, you can be pert, but you have to be young. It's not like with the English, where there is a different kind of measurement. In England, you can be a 90-year-old woman, respected as an actor, and work. You mentioned that at age 36, you're considered a character actress. I've never, ever, ever wanted to be the lead in movies. Never. Because the lead part is always attached to box office. No matter how interesting you are, if the money doesn't come in at the box office, you don't get your next movie. Take Faye Dunaway. She did Network, written by Patty Chayefsky, whom I worship. Somebody comes along only once a lifetime and is able to rip the falseness off of what the industry was. But she was remarkable and got the Oscar for Network. Two pictures later, my agent, who was also her agent, was sitting in the dailies watching a film she was working on. He overheard someone saying, "Look at that fat pig." There has been a deluge of horrifying Hollywood stories in light of hashtag MeToo. Did you have any of those kinds of encounters? No. What do you attribute that to? Those years I was acting, the directors that were coming out, the Norman Jewisons, the Hal Ashbys, they were bringing a new kind of film. It wasn't an atmosphere where old guys came on to you. My agent was gay. He couldn't care less about me. He was crazy about Joey. Grant married Fury in 1973. Angelica Houston spoke recently about the climate in Hollywood during the 1970s and the parties that people like Jack Nicholson threw. That was our group. Brenda Vaccaro and Michael Douglas were together. The parties at their house were amazing. Everyone you ever wanted to meet in your life. It was every week. The door opened and somebody from Paris would come in, somebody from England, some great comic, every director. Everybody was kind of beautifully stoned. It was like an open house in a golden time. It had love affairs to it, but no breakups. What do you mean by that? I mean there was a lot of flirting, but nobody broke up, except Brenda and Michael. Brenda comes here for dinner all the time, by the way. Michael and Catherine Zeta-Jones were just here 2 days ago having dinner. I have to show you the robe she gave me. She runs to the closet and returns with a pink robe. This is a Casa Zeta-Jones. What about your flirtations back during this period? I remember Warren Beatty calling me one time after shampoo was over. He said, "What are you doing tonight? You want to go down to Brenda and Michael's and meet there?" I said, "Sure." I thought to myself, the film is over. He's such a cute, sexy guy. I drove to Brenda's house. I was sitting on the couch talking to Warren when I saw his eyes wander over to a table in the middle of the house. I turned my head, and there was Dolly Parton. I saw myself being slowly dropped. She was so gorgeous. In the middle of this party, she was writing her list of what to get for the kitchen or something like that. I just saw him move right out of my life. Of course, she didn't pay any attention to him, which was so much more attractive to him. In Shampoo, you won an Oscar for playing the mother of Carrie Fisher's character. What do you remember about her, and more generally about being on set? Her character played tennis, so she was in white shorts. Her legs and arms were as white as her shorts were. She just was so exquisite, with that little face and her big dark eyes. She had a mystery to her. The scene where Warren was in the bedroom with Carrie, The day before we did it, he took me aside and he said, "You don't know what's going on in the bedroom between those two characters." Beatty wrote the script with Robert Towne. I said, "You're telling me what to think?" "No, but this is something you have." He couldn't stop, and he wouldn't stop. I was so upset that night that this was going to be my life for this movie, that he was going to tell me what to do and what to think, that I came in the next day and I quit. I went up to him and I said, "I'm off the movie. You can't tell me what to think." Of course he came over and said, "I'm sorry, it will never happen again." What happened with that scene with Carrie was that I had to come in with my hair in rollers for his character to take out. My character was so hot, so on fire with need for sex, that I didn't give an F who he effed in that room. I just wanted him to get upstairs and do me. That's almost the way I myself felt through all of that film. The set was so hot that the hairdressers were having hot dreams. It was like, whoa, I called a gay friend of mine who I'd always found so cute and so attractive and said, "Come down from San Francisco, wherever you are, and make love to me." He said, "You're scaring me." Next photo, flip side. Grant in 1975's Shampoo, for which she won the Best Supporting Actress Academy Award. You mentioned being game to meet up with Warren after filming. Were there any other co-stars you were drawn to in that way? No, Joey was 12 years younger than me. He was a producer on commercials and was going to be traveling around the country for jobs. I knew that there was going to be some cute little girl along the way that he would, you know, spend an afternoon with, or try and pack it in with, or go to the bathroom in the airplane with. If somebody came along that I could not resist, I wouldn't have stopped myself. I like to flirt. It's part of living. If he was serious about somebody, it would kill me. This is what I wrote for us when we got married. She gets up and returns with her and Joey's framed marriage vows, which read, "Will you please continue to be my dearest friend, to be there when I am afraid or lonely or unwanted, as you always have been, to help me grow even when growing separates us, and will you continue to acknowledge my freedom and solitary rights as I must acknowledge and respect your freedom and your solitary rights?" That was the question. And the answer, "I will try." "Are there any parts you wish you could be playing now?" I have big problems remembering names. During an intense meeting with House Un-American Activities Committee lawyers, Grant inadvertently mentioned two women. The terror that she had jeopardized their careers was so deep that recalling names continues to be a struggle. That has spread to lines. I had a trauma when I did a Neil Simon play with Peter Falk. In the second act, I forgot my lines. It was on the Wednesday matinee of the week that we were closing. It had been running for a year. Every actor has had a moment on stage where the lines go, and a co-star is usually able to say something like, "Are you talking about eggs?" But Peter didn't know how to save me. Peter turned to the audience and pointed at me with his thumb. All of a sudden, I was just exposed in front of these 1,000 people. The curtain had to come down. I tried two plays after that. I didn't forget my lines, but I was not the great investigative actress I wanted and needed to be. I was scared. When you're scared, you're finished. How incredible that you were able to pivot to filmmaking. It took me out of actor's hell. When I say actors, I mean every actor, the men, the women. You go up on stage and expose yourself. He was good. He was bad. She's getting old. Being behind the camera and choosing what you want to explore, it freed me. You're never free of how you look. You're never free. I'm always, "Look at this stuff, you know?" She gestures to products piled high on her desk. Makeup piled on makeup, all age-related. "There's about to be a retrospective of your films in Manhattan. How does that feel?" It gratifies me so much. I've made great documentaries, really great documentaries, and important ones. They were my war against the people who were blacklisting, to be able to speak with my own voice. Not acting, because with acting, you're saying other people's words. At what point did you decide you wanted to make films? I had just come back from doing Voyage of the Damned, and I got a call from AFI, American Film Institute, saying they were doing the first women's directing workshop. I had an idea to do the play The Stronger by August Strindberg. Nothing has been that magical for me to create a life out of 4 pages. When I was at the Los Angeles Film Festival for a presentation of The Stronger, I was sitting next to Barbara Koppel. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.